You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. I'm your host, Jace Kraft, and today I'm introducing you to Ryan Atkins. He's one of the fittest athletes on earth, from winning the Spartan Games to never losing a solo race over 8 hours. He has had an impressive career coming to Spartan racing with a unique background in unicycling to now being the top of the world in Spartan. He has 10 pages of achievements that I'm not going to read, but most recently you've seen him coming in second on the Amazon Prime Eco Challenge and first in the YouTube series, The Spartan Games. Ryan Atkins is here to talk to us about his recovery routine and how he prepares for ultra endurance races and what you can take from that, whether you compete in short races or 24-hour events like Ryan does. Let's get into it.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Hey, Ryan, it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Sweet. Well, I know from the intro, everybody's dying to know. An OCR athlete got his career start in unicycling. Yes. How in the world did you find unicycling as a competitive sport? And when were you a unicycler, if that's even a term?
Unicycler, unicyclist. Yeah, I mean, it all works. Basically, when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I started riding unicycles. And first I thought it was, well, actually my friend's dad got one and learned how to ride.
Okay.
And we thought it was super goofy. And we were like, I don't want to really have any part of this. You know, we were just like punk kids doing a lot of mountain biking at the time. and then we started seeing videos where people were riding like off road on these things and jumping off stairs and doing 360s.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, wait a minute. That's like pretty cool. So then we just got completely obsessed about it. And so yeah, while I was in basically, I guess it would have been like grade seven, eight to like, till I was about 18 or 19, I was just doing, I was doing other sports too, like in high school, but I was just doing a ton of unicycling. So I did mountain unicycling and trials unicycling were kind of like my big kind of draws. But, you know, there's a lot of different disciplines and it's like a whole nother world. There's just like,
yeah,
people who just love being, love riding unicycles and love like learning new tricks and just seeing how far you can take it. And there's like endurance unicycling, there's ultra distance unicycling, there's kind of freestyle unicycling, which looks like a figure skating on a unicycle. So they're doing like pirouettes and tricks on the ground. And yeah, so I actually was world champion in trials unicycling and mountain unicycling a few times. And
wow.
At one point, I had the unicycle high jump world record, which is pretty cool.
High.
I did 105 centimeters, and that's over a bar. So it's like about 3 feet, I guess. You're on flat ground, and you're jumping just over a bar. It's like about, yeah.
With the unicycle.
With the unicycle. And then landing on the ground on it.
So it's flat. You're cycling up to this bar.
Yeah,
and then
it's
just like what, a squat jump that you're kind of,
yeah, it's like a super explosive squat jump and you pull the unicycle up with you and jump over. So
that's crazy.
pretty wild world, but it was a heck of a lot of fun. And it kind of, I think it kind of taught me how to like approach obstacles, which obviously helped when I kind of started doing obstacle races.
Yeah, I would imagine balance obstacles shouldn't be an issue for you.
Yeah, exactly.
curious to know if you have any video of you doing the high jump.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff online. If you just type in Ryan Atkins unicycle on YouTube, there's a bunch of videos that should come up. I think one of them is called a Good Movie Part 2 or something. That one was probably like one of ones I just made myself, just like
like a highlight
and
reel,
messing around. But it's pretty good.
Cool. Yeah, I'll find some of those and put them in the show notes.
Sweet.
Yeah, so how do you get from unicycling then? I know you mentioned you're doing some mountain biking as well, but how'd that lead into your what now is, you know, a pretty dominant OCR or obstacle course racing for anybody that's listening that doesn't know what OCR means? But how do you get from unicycling, messing around with kids, and to, you know, world champion in the Spartan?
Yeah, so when I was going to university, I kind of started mountain bike racing, and I got like really into that, and that was kind of my first foray into endurance sports. So I would have been, I guess, 19 or so. Okay. So I kind of switched from unicycling to mountain biking, and I think, like, unbeknownst to me, all the unicycling was like really good kind of base training, because like when I did trials unicycling, like I said, which is like a session sport, so you're like you're jumping on the unicycle onto like tables and boulders and rails and stuff like that. But like, but you'd be out for like, you know, 8 hours a day, like riding a unicycle from place to place. And then you'd be like it's really intense while you're like doing a section or something. So it's like basically doing intervals like all day, every day, but it was just like, it's just fun. Right. So it's like, oh, yeah. You just like, you ride your unicycle like super easy. You go to the next like spot before some security guard kicks you out, and you would like jump on a bunch of like ledges or something for 20 minutes, and then you would ride somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so like when I started mountain biking, I was just like pretty fast, like right off the beginning. And that's, I think, because I had been like doing this secret training for years. And yeah, I raced mountain bikes for a bunch of years. I raced as high as like World Cup level for cross country mountain biking. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of started getting out of that and briefly found ultra running, which was, I was just like, oh, that's pretty cool. So I had never really run at all, but I just kind of had the fitness from mountain biking and started running. And then as I was kind of finding ultra running, I also found obstacle racing, and it was kind of like this convergence of like,
sure,
all these things for me at the same time. It was like the running with ultra running and like the fitness from mountain biking and like, I guess, the agility from unicycling. And it was just like a sport that really clicked and fit really well for like myself and my athleticism at the time. So I just I just jumped onto that and haven't looked back.
Cool. Yeah. So it's kind of like your background just happened to fit what would make a good, you know, OCR athlete.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I've heard it said, I think you've mentioned it before, that you haven't lost a race over 8 hours. Is that true?
Yeah. I was thinking about that today when I was running, actually. I was like, I don't think I have. Not that I can remember.
Yeah. Besides the Eco Challenge, which would be a team race and multi-day event.
And there's a 50. I've done a few 50 milers that I haven't won. I've done a few that I have won, so there's a couple of those which take about 8 hours anyways. So ultra marathons. But yeah, so, I think I was trying to add it up today, and I think it's probably around 30 like events.
That over 8 hours like, that you've
over
won.
8 hours that I've won. Yeah.
Wow. And among those are the world's toughest mudder, I believe, which is the 24-hour race, kind of circuit type. We'll get into this a little bit, but what, like, it takes a lot to be consistent on races that long, because, you know, anything can happen. You can be winning 6-7 hours into it and then, you know, pull something or just crash and burn. So like, what's your preparation for these races to make sure that you are so consistent throughout, you know, these ultra endurance races?
I think that it's kind of like it's like a lot of different things that would kind of come together. So for one, I'm like a very analytical person. I went to school for engineering, so I have my degree in mechanical engineering. So I love like problems and breaking them down and figuring out all the minutiae behind everything. So I think that really helps, because where a lot of people would just kind of maybe see a race, say, oh, it's a 24-hour obstacle race, and then kind of go and just do it, I would like, you know, watch 1,000 videos about it and like talk to people and try to break down like, okay, exactly, like why would the wheels fall off, you know, 10 hours in, or like, and how can I fix that, or how can I, you know, so I think that like having that mindset has really helped me. And then also,
interesting,
I've always been like, I've always just had like a good, I guess some people call it like being a grinder, but I don't really like that term. But like, I've been good at like sitting at like a pretty high percentage of like my threshold for a long time. And I think that that's like a partially like a train thing and partially like a physiological thing. So I've like never really been good at sprinting, like really high power. But I can go like pretty hard for like a long, long, long time. So I think that in those longer races, that's kind of like what you need. And, and between that and having like the, I guess the, like the discipline not to get overexcited at the beginning. Cause a lot of people, a lot of people just like, it's like, oh, a 24 hour race and they go out in the first lap and it's, they just go like ballistic. And then, you know, 5 hours in, they're totally dead. So I think, having that kind of discipline to not do that. So yeah, like a lot of different factors, but, I also find like the, like you said, there's a lot of things that can go wrong in a 24 hour race. But if you have the right like mindset, I find them like less stressful than like a shorter race because you have so much time. Like you can make, if you're doing like a, I don't know, a 5K event or something, it's so fast that if you make one mistake, like that could be it. That could be the event for you. You could lose because you made one mistake. But in a 24 hour race, you could make 50 mistakes and still win because like, like what's 1 minute in 24 hours, you know? It's not like a be all or end all like frame of time. So I guess it's like less stressful for me in that respect.
Sure. So you don't have to put as much pressure on yourself going into like each obstacle or, if you're like, hey, I need more food at this next stop and I'm going to have to, you know, stop and do that. You are able to take that rather than, like in a mile race, it's like if you your shoe comes off, you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Like you trip or like you look at the, like, you, I don't know, you like take one step on a curb and like just stub your toe and all of a sudden you're out of it. So,
So you, when you were talking about like planning for an event and being analytical and talking about like what could happen and that kind of stuff, it reminded me of the story of the race to the South Pole, where there's these two teams that were going to the South Pole. The one guy, basically he planned for everything to go right and made his plan and that kind of stuff. And the other guy planned for everything to go wrong and said, okay, this is what we're going to do if this happens or this happens. One guy made it out, back and the other guy did not. I would guess that your planning is similar to the guy that did make it out, whereas this is, there's things that are going to go wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, how are we going to deal with them when they do? What are some of those things in endurance races that you know that like, hey, this could go wrong? Or how do you like think about it in that way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a question like that, like a lot of these events are usually done in like pretty like more extreme like weather or something. So at World's Toughest Mudder, we'd be in and out of like water multiple times each lap, so you're like getting wet. And so like if it gets windy or if it gets cold at night, like becoming hypothermic is a really big concern, and it takes like a ton of people out of the race. So a lot of my like thought processes would be on like what could happen, that, you know, what happens if I get cold, what happens if, you know, what happens if my feet get cold, what happens if I get sand in my shoes, what happens. So like a lot of like little nitpicky things like that, where I would just have all these like I would train for it and I would try to like replicate the event as best as possible in my training. But until you get there and you do the event, you don't really know exactly how it's going to be. Like you can't, like, I'm not going to go out and run for 24 hours on like a 5 mile course with 25 obstacles just for training. Like that's kind of insane.
Yeah.
I might do like an 8 hour training run, but I'm not going to do like the recovery from a 24 hour like effort is huge. So it doesn't make sense to do as a training thing.
Yeah.
So then once you get into the event, you have all these kind of things that can come up. And so you're always making real time decisions about like, should I switch to a thicker wetsuit or should I put a jacket on, or should I change my shoes, or should I do this or do that? But I had all these kind of like contingency plans and all this gear and all this food and like, so like I would, most of the time I would just not even need it. Cause like when things go right, they go right. You just keep going. But when things go wrong, that's when you have, if you have all the, you know, plans B through Z to go to, then you can actually go there instead of just ruining your race. So like same thing with food. It's like, and a 24 hour race, it's like a massive thing is what you eat and what you can digest and what you can take on as fuel and keep going. So having like tons of food and tons of options for food and having like tested what works for you and what doesn't. And then maybe if these things that you think work don't work, having other options. I've had races where like I'm neck and neck with a guy and then all of a sudden like they just can't, their stomach starts getting kind of funky and they can't take in calories and you've already been racing for 10 hours. So you're like, you already have like almost like no glycogen. So if, as soon as you get behind on food, your pace goes out the window and like your race is over. So I guess there's a lot of different kind of ways to plan and figure out. And
So I got two follow-up questions from that. One, just to put it in perspective for the listener, like, as a percentage, how much do you think on average you overpack, like that you have prepared that you don't use in a race? Like,
well, probably I'd say like 70 to 80% of the stuff I bring, I don't use.
Okay. So you're packing like four or five times more stuff than you actually need. Cool. And then I know I think I've seen it on Instagram, maybe on yours or Lindsay's, about you like planning out, okay, I weigh this much, I need this many calories for this long of a race. Like, walk us through kind of the calculations, the nitty gritty of like calorie intake planning.
I mean, basically, well, it used, there's all these like kind of rules of thumb behind like calorie intake, and they say that you can only absorb around 400 calories per hour. And it's, it is trainable to a certain extent. And it is kind of like based on like individuals as well. So some people that might be 300, some people that might be 500. I've kind of found that I can like take in around between 400 and 500 an hour.
Without getting like testing. An upset stomach.
Yeah. And that's like, steady state. That's like from hours, like 8 to like 24. That's not like, you know, in the first couple hours or whatever. So I guess for me it would be, I focus a lot on like more liquid calories as kind of like my base. So I would do something that would be like a drink mix, but like a pretty concentrated one. So I'm getting my like fluid plus I'm getting my calories.
Sure. And probably like around electrolyte drink or
There's I think SIS makes a product that's a pretty high calorie like drink mix, and so does Morton and a few other companies. They're all, they all work pretty well. And then I would have like a solid, some kind of solid fuel as well, like whether it's like a gummy or whatever.
Do you have a go-to on that?
Not really. They're all, it's all probably pretty similar. But then I do really like maple gels. So I would probably take like one maple syrup gel, which is about 90 calories per hour as well.
Sounds like a Canadian thing.
Yeah. It's like 250 calories of like liquid carb, whatever. And then something solid, another probably 100, 150 calories of that, plus like a gel. And that's kind of what I would just do. And like the solid thing, I would kind of vary to give like a bit of variance in my, palate. So maybe one lap that would be like a few bites from a piece of pizza, or another lap, it would be like, a cookie or like a coconut macaroons are actually pretty good. situations like that. So I kind of like, I have like part of it that kind of stays the same, and then part of it that like changes up, and then you just keep going and just It's honestly a lot of it's like an eating competition, because you really can't, like, you can't get behind on that, because eventually it catches up to you.
Yeah, cool. What about like just overall fluid intake? Do you add water into that so you're getting liquid, like more liquid, or is your,
you know... Sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah, I would kind of, sometimes I would take in Pedialyte, which is, it's like, if they make it for babies, but it's like basically like a really high concentration of electrolytes, a bit of that, or just some water. I think that with, for the intake of like fluid and like water specifically, it's really hard, because a lot of times, like, you can go, you can overdo it really easily as well. Especially when you're like running for that long and you're like eating so much. So you really have to kind of like judge your fluid intake based on kind of how you feel and how like thirsty you are.
Yeah.
Cause I actually think it's better to get in like an event like that, if it's not super hot, if it's like overnight or it's in a colder environment, I think it's easier to get like overhydrated than underhydrated, just because you're like, everyone has like a plan and they're like, and like the nutrition industry pushes like sports drinks so hard. They're like, oh, if you're not drinking Gatorade every 15 minutes, you will die out there. which is like, it's like insane. So like everyone's like, oh, I gotta drink so many electrolytes, but it's actually like, yeah, it's easy to overdo it. In a lot of races I have overdone it and gotten like, end up getting super puffy and like things get really swollen. And yeah, I think it's better to, I mean, ideally you'd be like, hit it right on and drink the right amount for how much you're sweating. Yeah. But I think if you'd have to choose going under or going over a little bit, I would like go under a little bit in terms of fluid intake. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The thing is, if you go under, you get thirsty, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you like under drink, you get the thirst mechanism and you get really thirsty, and that's like a pretty powerful mechanism to be like, oh, I better drink. So then you will drink. Whereas if you go over, you don't really, there's no real mechanism to be like, I've taken in too much fluid and now I have hyponatremia, and now like that's a really serious problem to have. So
yeah. Cool. So what about like races that aren't that long, like a super or a beast or a sprint obstacle course race that are like that 1 to 2 hours? Do you do as much planning for nutrition leading up to that?
Yeah, like actually you kind of nailed it. It's like, it's events like that, it's almost more important what you eat and drink like the days leading up to it instead of like during the race. Like during the race, it's pretty easy for like a 1 to 2 hour event. In obstacle races, a lot of times like you're not really carrying anything. It's pretty hard to carry water, because if you have a waist belt, like you're flipping over walls, so like the waist belt's gonna jab you in the gut or something. So it's not really great to have like water bottles and stuff like on your body.
Yeah.
But they do have like little water stations where they only have water. So you're not really taking any sports drink. You're just drinking water. So I'll usually race with just a couple gels and just take the water on the course. And it's like, it's pretty simple, pretty easy. But yeah, before the race, I like to, I'm trying to remember now because it's been so long since I've raced with the pandemic. But it's like, it's like eating. I usually eat really healthily and like the days leading up to a race, like maybe 4 or 5 days before, I'll like kind of cut out anything that's like bad. Normally I'll eat like a little bit of chocolate during the day or in the evening, but I'll cut that out and I'll just focus on eating real food, having enough of it, and having like good salads and vegetables every day. And then usually like a day or two before, I'll actually cut out almost all the like really cruciferous vegetables. So like I'll try not to eat as much lettuce or broccoli or things like that, because I'm like and then the day before I don't really eat any meat either, so it's just like stuff that you know you can digest and that's not gonna like kind of sit in your stomach heavy during a race.
Why do you take out broccoli and spinach and lettuce 2 days?
I'm just like, well, it's not going to help me in the race. Like, I eat so much of these vegetables every day of the year that and it also takes a while for you to digest a lot of those vegetables. And if they're really like, it takes a lot of energy from your body to like break down meats and to break down like really fibrous vegetables. So if you like, I want my body to be as recovered as possible coming into the race. So if I can like take out the process of trying to like break down all those things in my stomach and just eat things that are going to give me easy energy.
Yeah.
Then when I get to the race, I'm going to be like more rested and ready to perform. And I'm not going to have like, my gut's not going to be full of stuff that I don't need.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're replacing those then with like pastas and fruits and that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Or,
okay.
Yeah. Basically anything that like you think, like it's pretty, I guess in my mind, it's like pretty simple. It's like food that like is easy to digest. So like, I don't know, yeah, like pastas or like potatoes or rice or breads or like fruits, vegetable, or I just said not as many vegetables, but like bananas would be like a really good example of like something that bananas. You can just eat. It's going to be easy on your stomach.
Yeah.
You know, away you go. So yeah.
Okay.
That's always worked out really well for me, because sometimes when you're racing, like you're pushing so hard that you don't want to have anything like in your stomach that's like might come back up as well.
Yeah. Have you had that happen?
I've never like thrown up, but I've definitely had it like come up, and it's it's not a very pleasant feeling.
Yeah, I've only thrown up like a few times in my life after a race or workout, and it all has to do with orange juice. So don't pound some orange juice before you go do a hard effort.
I had a friend who I used to race mountain bikes with, and he would always eat strawberries before he would race, and he would always throw up strawberries, and it took him like a year to be like, I guess you just like strawberries so much, but it took me a year to be like, I shouldn't eat strawberries on the morning that I race. And I was like, there you go.
Yeah. So how does like preparing on the front end, whether it be for your workout or for your race, affect the recovery of the back end of the race and the workout? Do you see a correlation when like you properly prepare for a workout or a race on how fast you're able to recover from it?
I think that's a really good question. I think that there's a lot of different factors that play into like how fast you recover. And that would be like, obviously, like you said, nutrition before, but also like how hard you push yourself. Mm-hmm. If it's like a workout that's like way outside of what you normally do.
Yeah.
Because I find like if I haven't done a lot of, say, like running speed work, and then I suddenly start, you're going to take a while to recover no matter how well you fuel before that.
Yeah.
But I definitely think you're right. Like coming into workouts and coming into races, you know, better fueled, better prepared will definitely reduce like your recovery time.
Cool. So let's get a little bit back into your background as an athlete. I want to talk about the Eco Challenge for just a little bit, because you weren't really like featured at all in the actual like showing on Amazon. I knew you were in there because I just was getting into obstacle course racing in 2020, but I didn't get a race all except one time because everything was canceled. So, but I was watching 2019, 2018, and 2017 kind of, you know, replays and stuff on YouTube. And you get second a lot, by the way, in those.
Yeah, thanks. It's true.
My wife and I were like, well, who do you think is gonna win? And we're like, well, I bet Ryan gets second.
Pretty safe bet.
So we're watching the Eco Challenge, we're watching for you and stuff, and we're like, well, where is Ryan? Like, and then we see the Canadian team where we're like, probably there. We're like, well, what are the odds they get second?
yeah, exactly.
So not trying to rub this in your face or anything. But
we need counseling after this.
What was like your mindset going into that? Because if I'm not mistaken, it was kind of your first adventure multi-day event, kind of like that in a team setting. Did you have expectations of, hey, we're gonna go for the lead? Or was it just kind of like, hey, we have, you know, four really good athletes here. I know Rhea Coble was with you, I believe. And like, let's just see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think we went into the race with like a like an air of like quiet confidence, I guess. Like the two, so we had two guys on our team who were like pretty experienced adventure racers, Bob Miller and Scott Ford. And Bob's like was our navigator, and he's like a bit of a legend in like the adventure racing world. And he but he hadn't raced in I think like 8 or 9 years or something. So he hadn't raced seriously in like a long time. And same thing with Scott. They're both dads now. They're in their like mid-40s and stuff. And then we had myself and Rhea, and I had done one multi-day adventure race, which was like 4 or 5 years ago now. And that was kind of it. And Rhea, I don't think, had done any. And so I think we kind of knew that we could do really well, just like, but we knew that we could also like totally kind of shit the bed and like it could go really poorly for us. But yeah, we came in with no expectations before the race. Like all the other, like I would talk to teams and people at the venue before the race, and they had all kind of, they were all kind of like had dismissed us. They were like, oh yeah, like you're like an obstacle racer can't do well in an adventure race. Like that's crazy. Like it takes so many years to like figure this out and to like, you know, put this together. They were all just like super dismissive of us. And so it was pretty easy that for us to just show up and like just do the task at hand and just keep moving forward. And just, I mean, we were really positive. We never like whenever we would make a mistake, we would just like put it behind us immediately. And there was like no real hierarchy on the team. It was just, everybody was just worked so well together. And I think those kind of factors led to our success ultimately. And yeah, I mean, we beat like a ton of really good teams. And like if there had been a couple of circumstances that had been different, we could have won the event outright. So yeah, like on the second last night, we got lost for like, we saw the Kiwis ahead of us and we were like maybe an hour behind them. And then like an hour later, we got lost for 6 hours in this tall grass. Man. So, and then like, and then the same thing on the paddle the next night, the final paddle out in the ocean. We were just like, we made another navigation error, went to the wrong island, got like totally turned around.
Oh man.
So we wasted like hours and then we finished like an hour and a half behind them or something. So yeah, there was a lot of, In the end, we were like, oh, an hour and a half, like, dang it. But really, we were just super psyched that we, you know, finished second, finished on the podium and had such a good race.
So anybody listening that's like, what's the eco challenge? I talked with Sonia Wick on it in episode 4. So you can go back and listen to that. But basically, it's multi-day, multi-discipline. There were mountain biking, there were hiking, there were paddling out in the ocean and on these little tiny boats. But I'm curious, just the way they filmed it, it made it seem like, you know, towards the end of the show, you guys got more attention because they're like, hey, this is in second place. And and the Kiwis, which was, they're from New Zealand, right? They were the team that ultimately ended up won it. They flipped their boat out in the ocean, and then they had to get a new boat and stuff. And then there was all this drama of, is the Canadians gonna pass them while they have to wait and that kind of stuff. Were you ever ahead of them and then get turned around and they end up finishing, or was it always they were ahead of you?
No, at the end they were always ahead of us, but actually on the first day we we were in first place for like a few hours, and they never really showed that in the film. But after the jungle trek, when we got back onto the boats, we were in first place for a couple hours. So that was pretty cool.
Cool. So I would imagine preparing for a race like that, as far as like nutrition and stuff, would differ a little bit from, say, the world's toughest mudder, because you get, you know, in the world's toughest mudder, it's like a 5-mile loop or something that you would get aid station every time. Whereas this, you could be, you know, overnight or long stretches before you get to camp again. Where you wouldn't want to take, you know, 5 times more stuff than you need just because of the weight. Yeah. Did you err on the side of too much, or did you scale it back so you didn't have to carry as much?
Yeah, actually, I was kind of pretty proud of like the system I came up with for this.
Okay.
But so like the way it works is, you have these camps, and everyone has a TAC, which is like a team assistant crew. So it's like a person that we've, like a friend of ours, who goes to every camp and sets up a little tent for us. And, you know, we can go and sit down and like clean our feet and eat some food and reload our packs before we head off again. But every camp was between, for the top teams, it was between about 20, just over a day to a day and a half between each camp. So like 28 to like 36 or 40 hours maybe between each camp.
Okay.
So that means you have to carry enough food to get you through that section. So what I did, but you don't know what the section is going to be like coming up to it. So when you get to the camp, they give you the map and they say, here's the map.
Sure.
And you have to plot your course. And then while they're plotting their course, they're like, oh, it looks like we have a 40-kilometer jungle trek that'll probably take us, you know, 4 or 5 hours. So then you're like, okay, 5 hours. And then they were like, oh, and then you've got a 100-kilometer mountain bike ride that'll probably take us 10 hours. So you kind of add it up, but everything is like really rough math, and if you get lost or something, you could add 10 hours like pretty quickly to your like leg there. So basically what I did is I took Ziploc bags. And I put in, I would put, some bags had like 12 hours of food in them, and some bags had like 6 hours of food in them. And some of the food would be like, and I kind of divided it up into like paddling food / riding food or trekking food. Because I figured when you're trekking, you have your hands free to eat. So you can kind of eat things that are more difficult to eat, like maybe Pringles or things like that. Whereas when you're paddling, you only really have one hand to quickly like shove food in your face. Or if you're mountain biking, you can kind of do the same. So it was like different food based on like how you could take it in. So when we got to the section, when we got to the camp and we kind of like looked at the map and we saw, I was like, okay, we'll be out for 36 hours. There's going to be 12 hours of mountain biking. So I would grab a 12-hour Ziploc, throw it in my backpack. Yeah. And then I would say, oh, and then there's going to be, you know, maybe 20 hours of trekking. So I'd grab like a 12-hour and a 6-hour for like trekking food. And I'd put it in my pack, and then we would just, and then I would kind of always have about 5 or 6 hours of like backup food. In case we got lost or in case it took longer. So I was like basically like counting like the exact hours if everything went right, and then adding like 5 or 6 hours of food. So it was like, it was like there was definitely a bit of a safety envelope, but there was also like, it was pretty lean because on one or two of the legs when we got lost, we like showed up to camp like finishing our last like morsels of food. So it worked pretty well because like weight is really important in adventure racing, because you're moving, like we covered 700 odd kilometers over the 7 days, and you're moving the whole time, so every extra pound on your back is like it's huge. So you don't really want to carry anything extra that you don't have to. Because you also have all sorts of mandatory gear. So like you have to carry a tarp, and you have to carry like one of those silver bivy bags that like you could sleep in if you had to, which we did. You have to carry like first aid kit and all this stuff.
So was this system pretty novel? Like, did you surprise more veteran adventure races? Like, wow, you really thought this through, or was it like?
I know that I told everyone else on my team. I was like, oh, we should do this, and everyone's like, that's a great idea, and so we did it. But I don't really know how the other teams did it, because it's like. Like there's some things that you share, there's some things that everyone does the same, but then there's a lot of little things like that that are like little clever ideas that you come up with that mm-hmm. can make a big difference. And I mean, I think it made a big difference just because you only have, so you had to spend, I think it was an hour and a half in the camp, in each camp.
Sure.
So you have an hour and a half, but like it's not much time. By the time you like clean your feet and like mm-hmm. eat as much food as you can and like, maybe have a 15-minute nap. Like every moment is precious. So like saving a few minutes by having all those pre-done bags and just like popping them in and knowing, okay, we're good for food. Instead of standing there in front of a big pile of food for 10 minutes and going, do I want these Snickers? Should I take these chips? Should I take this bar? Yeah. Should I take the sandwich? Like, so it really came big in terms of like time saving and in terms of, I guess just like not making mistakes for the food. But yeah. I don't know how other teams did it. I wouldn't be surprised if someone else did the same thing.
Yeah. So they're doing it, or they're planning, I think, another one in Patagonia. I would imagine that. Did you apply for that again?
Yeah. We applied for the
same team.
Same team. Yeah.
Cool. So, well, I hope you get in. That'd be fun to watch. Maybe they'll give you more coverage this time.
Yeah, I think so. I think none of the producers thought, like, they were like the other teams. They were kind of like, didn't think we were really, going to do very well until they were like, oh, shoot, they're, like, doing really well. They're going to, like, maybe win. Or, like, I just think it would have been funny if we had won and they had, like, no footage of us because, like, they weren't really filming us that much because they didn't think we were going to win. And, but that would have been hilarious. And then like, shit.
Yeah. So this last year then in 2020, October was the Spartan Games, which is a YouTube series that was highly publicized as well. And you ended up taking the victory there. So I want to spend a little bit of time on that. It was a different type of event. For anybody who's listening doesn't know, it was a cross between strength events and endurance events, multi-day, but they had, unlike the adventure challenge, they had breaks in between, from at least what we can see as a viewer. So my first question is, do you think it leaned heavier on or favored endurance athletes or strength athletes?
I think it leaned like 51% towards endurance athletes. Like, I think it was pretty even, but I think it was like just a bit more on the endurance athlete side. Yeah.
Okay. Why would you say that?
I'd say that because like, not only does, well, it's a hard question to answer because like, I think on the surface it looks more endurance based, but then like the endurance athletes had to do a lot more as well. Like we had to do 5 laps, whereas some of the run and the mountain bike, whereas some of the strength athletes had to do like 2 or 3 laps, which is like less than half, which is huge. It's huge from like a impact perspective. It's a huge from like a recovery perspective, energy output. Like we were having to put out so much more energy than like the strength athletes, whereas like then you go to a strength event and like the strength athletes have to like compete for, I don't know, 30 seconds to like 5 minutes, and then if you're really bad at the strength event, maybe you have to compete at it for like 8 minutes. So like, what's that, an extra like 100 calories, whereas like riding your mountain bike for an extra 3 hours, that's like an extra 3,000 calories.
Sure.
So I think that like that factor alone like brought the balance really back down to even, because the strength athletes were having to put out so much less energy over the course of the 4 days.
So back in episode 14 I interviewed Corinna and we were talking about also like she agrees with you that it was pretty even, but I'm curious to know your take on like just the athletes invited, because obviously that would play a big role in favoring endurance versus strength, because if you invite a lot of endurance athletes, then they're all competing for those precious points up at the endurance level, yeah. But then the strength could walk away with it if there's only one or two athletes in the strength category. Do you think it was pretty even as far as athletes invited to the event in both men and women?
I think on the women's side, it was pretty even. I think there was a good representative of strong girls and a good representative mm-hmm. of like endurance girls. I don't know, strong would, what would you call that? Like fit or endurable?
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, a good mix of like, you know, people who were like more endurance based. Mm-hmm. On the guy's side, I think it was not as fair. I think that Hunter ended up not really having anyone there to like take points from him or like sure. push him to the end. I know Kurt kind of put up a pretty good battle with him in like the, you know, say like the tug of war or the mm-hmm. wrestling, but like in the Decafit events, there was no CrossFit athletes there mm-hmm. to like really go against Hunter and to like beat him in those like Decafit events.
Yeah.
Whereas with myself, there was Josiah in like every endurance event. He was there just like breathing down my neck and making me work for every single point.
Yeah.
So I think that was, but like, I mean, conversely, there could have been like, if an athlete, like, I don't know, if they had invited someone like Jim Walmsley, like obviously he would have won like the trail event, or if mm-hmm. they had invited like Matt Fraser, he would have like beat Hunter at like all the strength events. So like,
yeah,
you can kind of find athletes to make arguments for like whatever outcome you think, you know, would be just or unjust. But yeah. I think that the way that it stood, it was like slightly easier on the strength side for Hunter.
Sure. And there was like, you know, the Island Ninja, Grant McCartney.
Yeah.
And Kurt, I mean, they were both strength, but like you said, their discipline wasn't, you know, kind of Decafit where that was. Do you think that Joe DeSena like put this together in hopes like that the Spartan athletes would win and like elevate the Spartan brand?
I don't know. I think that there was like obviously I'm sure they were kind of like hoping for that, but I think that mm-hmm. They were hoping to just get eyes on the event, I think.
Yeah.
So if they had been able to find, like, I don't know, if they had been able to recruit Michael Phelps to come and, like, compete
sure.
and, like, do the swim, like, they would have done it because a ton of people would have tuned in just to watch him
you know,
do that, even though he would have, like, absolutely owned us. They just wanted athletes that were, like, good at their sports that they mm-hmm. could get on such – it was fairly short notice for a lot of sure. the athletes and stuff. So I'm sure, like you said, that part of them wanted – Spartan athletes to do well, but they also wanted just people there to attract viewership.
From a publicity standpoint, it was a great move getting, you know, different athletes into the Spartan kind of world, if you
totally.
will, because I mean, obviously that was their Spartan's best YouTube videos ever, like by a long shot. A lot of eyes there. Cool. But we're getting close to the end of our time, but I have one question on beetroot juice, because I know, and then I have some questions from the audience, but I know you're sponsored by Human, and they do like this beetroot juice. And we had an episode, our very first episode, we interviewed Dr. Tom Clifford, who has done a ton of research on the effects of beetroot juice and recovery and that kind of stuff. So I'm curious to know how you implement beetroot juice into your training and recovery.
Yeah, well, actually, we actually just had a call with Human, like we did like an athlete summit virtually about 2 weeks ago. And so they had some of their researchers on the call with us. And that was really cool because they actually have like science. They have like a science advisory board.
Okay.
Like within the company. And they're like they have this guy named Dr. John Ivey, who's like the guy who discovered nitric oxide. And they have like Nobel Prize laureates in the field that like consult with them with their products. So like first of all, like, I'm a big believer of their product. And they told us, like, he went on a spiel that was like half an hour long about like all the different pathways that like the nitrates and the nitrites and everything goes through in order to like kind of funnel this effect into our bodies. Sure. But they also like talked about all the reasons why like the kind of their product, and I sound like a salesman, but why their product is like kind of better than anything on the market. And like, sure. One of the things was like, they don't use organic beets because they tested every beet that they like put in their thing. And like non-organic beets were like higher in nitrates
sure.
than organic beets. So like, that's what they choose. And they like hand select every beet that goes into the powder and all this stuff. But basically like the takeaway is like, everybody should basically be taking this product. It's like, it's so good. Everyone should be on like a beetroot powder. And if I had to recommend one, it would definitely be like the Beet Elite powder. It's like head and shoulders, like above everything else on the market. Yeah. And it's like, I hung up the phone from this like athlete summit, and I called my mom, and I was like, cause she's like really into nutrition and like things like that. And I'm like, Mom, you have to be taking Beet Elite. Like, I want you around for my grandchildren. I want you to have a healthy heart. Like, yeah. I want you to keep hiking with your friends, like, as you know, as long as you can in your life. Like,
yeah,
just take it. Like, I'm not going to explain to you the science because I'll be here for half an hour and you probably won't remember any of it, but you should just take it. So yeah, I take it every day or almost every day. And I try to take it if I'm doing like a hard workout, I'll take it beforehand.
Like, how
and
long
then
before?
If I'm between about an hour and a half an hour.
Okay.
And the effect, according to Dr. John Ivey, the effect lasts about 2 hours.
Okay.
And so if you're doing like a long event, you can just keep taking it. You can keep taking it every 2 hours, yeah. just keep pounding it. Because it keeps happening but the other thing is it's kind of like a cumulative effect. So if you don't like, you get a really good effect out of taking it every day. So on days where I don't train hard, where I'm not taking it like before my training, I'll put like a scoop into like my smoothie or something like in the afternoon. And they make some stuff that has like, it's like a beet powder, but plus collagen. Mm-hmm. And they make another one that has like an immunity booster kind of complex in it. So I'll kind of switch off between those two because I figure I should probably like not get sick and stuff like that. So that's my I try to take it pretty much every day, and I do take it before like every race, and anytime I'm doing a hard workout, I'll take it.
Okay. And pretty easy on the stomach too.
Yeah I've never really found any. The scoops are pretty small in the Beet Elite.
Okay.
In the Super Beets they're a bit bigger, but it's like it's pretty concentrated.
Okay.
So I just mix it in, and I mix it pretty strong. So I'm not taking in like a ton of, I'm not drinking water. Like 2 cups of water and then going and hammering out intervals.
Yeah.
I'll do it with like maybe I'd say between 250 and like 350 mils of water.
Okay.
So like not that much. And it's just like a little sip.
How's the taste? Cause I've had beetroot juice. I haven't had human or Beet Elite, but any beetroot juice I've had in the past, it's been disgusting. So what's your take on the taste?
So they make the ones that have like the collagen and stuff in it. They make some like fruit punch flavors that are actually really good.
Sure.
They're like, they almost taste like a juice, like a juice you would almost buy if it was just a juice, but like not quite that good, but close. Yeah. And then the Beet Elite is like just straight up beets. It's like black cherry flavored a bit. It's pretty good. I would not like rush out and buy like jugs of it and like just, you know, have it in my fridge just to sip on. But it's I'd say it's palatable, and it's like it's good enough. It's
like a protein bar or shake where it's like you're not just gonna have them because you are casually, you know, crave it, but
that being said, the fruit punch ones that I like usually put in my smoothies, those ones are actually, they're good. They like make the smoothie like taste like better. So those ones are really good. But yeah, there's more there's more powder in them, so you have to take like more of them.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I have some questions from the audience to close here. And if anybody's listening, you're like, how do you, I submit a question, just join my email list. I'll pull it out who I'm interviewing or coming up to interview. And I sometimes post it on my Instagram as well. So you can submit questions. With that, but Ryan, these are meant to be like 60 seconds or less. So just kind of first thing that comes to our head. In the episode that I interviewed your wife, Lindsay, I asked this same question and it was brought back up again. So not trying to get you in trouble, but from your non-biased opinion, who do you think is the most talented athlete, you or Lindsay?
I think Lindsay has more natural talent than I do. I think that like she just like has such an engine and she can just like, yeah, like when she's on form mm-hmm. and like firing on all cylinders, like it's incredible. I remember one year at Lake Tahoe, we were at the venue and we were there a couple days early and we were doing like 20 seconds on, yeah. 10 seconds off. And we were like going up the mountain like this. And she was, and I was doing it at the same time as her.
Yeah.
And like, every time we were finishing each interval, we were at the same place. And I was like, uh-oh, like either I'm really out of shape or Lindsay is just flying. And yeah. We went through like 10 of these intervals and I would walk in between because I was like getting embarrassed. And because I didn't want her to like beat me in the intervals, so I'd like take a few steps as I'm like supposed to be standing still, but I would like kind of step at the end or like start like a second early to try to like move forward more. And yeah. She kept like finishing at the same place as me, and so yeah, like that's like a pretty good example of her just like absolutely,
yeah,
rock star powerhouse.
Well, one of you is lying because she said you, so. Okay, so the other another question, best way to train for like obstacle course races when you're on a tight schedule? So there's a lot of people, you know, have a full-time schedule. Where would you start? And maybe a better way to answer this is kind of what's the blend of strength versus endurance? If you can only choose like one per day,
I think it really depends on the person. Mm-hmm. And whenever someone asks me about like, oh, I want to be a Spartan racer, sure. or how much should I train or whatever, I usually say like just go out and do a race, because mm-hmm. it's so hard to say. Like if you're like a rock star track athlete and you show up and you want to do a Spartan race, like you probably should do more strength work mm-hmm. than running work. But if you're someone who spends all their time in the gym or who's like can go and bust out 50 pull-ups, no problem, then you should probably spend more time running. Yeah. But that being said, if you're time crunched, I would focus on like running most days.
Sure.
It's usually the races do come down to like mostly running, and then just like on your rest days or recovery days, I would really focus on like obstacle technique mm-hmm. and things like that. You can do a lot with like without that much like pull on your body just by doing like sure. Hangboard sessions or by like yeah. practicing going over walls efficiently, things like that.
Cool. And if you do come from a running background and are getting into OCR, your shoulders will be sore for months.
Yeah. Good luck.
I think my shoulders have doubled in size and they're still like, you know,
yeah.
not big. Okay. So in your opinion, when do you think OCR or Spartan will become an Olympic sport? Will it be 2024, 2028? Will it ever?
I don't know, to be honest. I guess it depends how optimistic I'm feeling on when you ask me that question. Because I don't think it would happen in 2024. It'd be cool if it happened in 2028. But
yeah.
I think it should be an Olympic sport. I 100% think so. There's, yeah. I think that like Spartan racing, obstacle racing is like the truest representation of like what humans should be able to do. Like mm-hmm. our hunter-gatherer, you know, forebears, like they had to run through the forest just like we do, off trail, jump over logs, carry heavy things, like everything yeah. that we do. So it's like the truest expression of what humans should be doing. But every sport that's in the Olympics is like some kind of modernized, like kind of bastardized version of that. Like
yeah,
like hockey, like look at hockey, great sport. I'm a Canadian, so I love it. But like, it's so far from like anything that was required from humans through like the majority of history.
Like the original Olympics, you know?
Yeah,
you
get, exactly.
You get close in like probably track events. I get your point.
Even track though, like you're running on like this prepared surface. Whereas like, if you're just like, if you go back 10,000 years, how many like flat roads could you find? Like almost none. People were just going like cross country, like through the brambles and over logs and mud holes and having to swim a little bit, things like
Although, I think in the first the first Olympics, everybody was naked too. So
it's true.
I don't know if we should replicate all that.
Little loincloths.
Yeah.
Spartan logo.
That would be a hit on YouTube. So, okay, last question here. What is the best part about being Canadian?
Oh, I think for me, it's like seasons. Just like I love the, I love like the different seasons and like most Canadians get to experience that. We have most everywhere in Canada, we have, you know, pretty good winters and then pretty great summers. And so I love like the difference of a winter. I love being forced to like ski instead of like being somewhere like in where you could run and mountain bike like all year long. I love those sports, but it's like it gives you such variety, and I think that variety is the spice of life, and that like gets me really excited. So and I think the rest of the world thinks we're really nice, which is kind of nice, but I think there's like there's jerks in Canada just like everywhere else. So
they just hide.
They just hide, and then maybe they don't travel. So that's why, you know.
Cool. Well, if you're listening and you need more Ryan Atkins in your life, you can find him on Instagram at Ryan Atkins Diet. Which I guess that's another question. Ryan Atkins Diet. What's with the diet?
I don't know. It's just like, you know, when you make those like emails in grade nine and you're like, you're like the cool guy, 69. Like when Instagram came out, I'm like always, I always have like weird things in my head. And I was like, Ryan Atkins, got to add something to the end there. So it was like a play on the Atkins diet. But I don't know.
When you made it, did you think that, you know, you'd be this like, kind of athlete star that had people follow you? And
no, not really. It's just like, I guess I should do this Instagram thing. Everyone else is doing it.
Cool. Any place else where somebody could follow along with you in your journey?
That's probably the best place.
Cool. Awesome. Well, it was great having you on the show, Ryan. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right, episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jase, J-A-S-E, at scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.